We would like to thank Karen and Jake Abelevitz for sponsoring this morning's Locks and Learn Le'iloi Nishmas, Jake's beloved parents Eliyahu ben Abban Le'i Bas Avram, and Karen's brother Yeshua ben Shimon Dov, that Hashemah should have an Aliyah. So for those who aren't aware, Jake and Karen are sponsoring this morning, but they also sponsor every week. We have a Perkei Avos Locks and Learn. We are getting up to almost there, sheer 100. So if you calculate, that's around 4,000 bagels, 250 pounds of lox, etc., etc. So we are indebted to them for all the calories that we have consumed and will continue to consume, and the Torah as well for today and all the other weeks. And everyone's invited back on a weekly basis to learn with us on Sunday mornings. But today we have a special Aseret Yemei Tshuva Lox and Learn entitled Cognitive Behavioral Tshuva. We're going to be looking at Jewish sources, psychological sources, to help us grow during this time of year in order to affect positive and hopefully lasting change. With the caveat that even though it's called cognitive behavioral tshuva, for those who weren't aware, I assume if you're here, you're generally aware that this is a play on cognitive behavioral therapy. This is not a therapy session. It's not a group therapy session. This is not, so just keep that in mind. If anybody wants to consult with me afterwards to talk about stuff, we can, you know. But for this, sheer is a sheer. Hopefully we can learn principles that are used in therapy as well for our own self-growth, even if it's not a clinical, diagnosable issue that we might have. I think one of the things that I'm going to try to convey over the course of this year is that for our everyday problems, our everyday struggles, absent any mental illness or diagnoses, these therapy strategies that do help for the more intense problems can also help for general change tshuva processes. So the shiur is, as you can tell, for those who come on a weekly basis, I'm usually ambitious for how much I want to cover. The 8 pages in front of you is probably a little bit too ambitious. We are not going to look at everything inside, but the general balance that I would like to do over the course of the next hour or so is to give a theoretical framework to understand the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy as well as how that is seen in Jewish sources, but then spend a decent chunk of time, the second part, focusing on practical strategies. So there's going to be some theory and some practical strategies. So to start off with just the basics of what cognitive behavioral therapy is, in part one, first page that you have over here is the famous CBT triangle. Even put it on the flyer. So basically, this encapsulates the core of CBT. The idea is that if we think about ourselves, our personalities, we can break everything down into 3 categories for the most part. Simplified to some extent, but not really to a larger extent. This is really the crux of who we are. We are a combination of our thoughts, our emotions, and our behaviors. And what this triangle tries to show is that these three, the thoughts, the emotions, and the behaviors, all interact with each other in reciprocal fashions. So the way I think is going to impact the way that I feel emotionally. And we'll elaborate on all of this. The way that I behave will also impact on the way that I feel. And the way I behave will impact the way that I think. And the way I think is going to impact the way that I behave. And it all intertwines in this triangle that each thing leads to the other. Thoughts lead to emotions. Emotions lead to thoughts. Thoughts lead to behaviors. Behaviors could lead to thoughts, emotion, etc., etc., etc. So there's a fascinating source. We're not going to do it all inside, but the Nesiva Shalom in source number 1 says something very powerful related to Perkei Avos that has to do with this CBT triangle. And he says that when we say in Perkei Avos, Al Shosh Dvarim HaOlam Omed, the 3 things the world stands, what are those 3 things? Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim. Excellent. Okay, Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim. The Nesiva Shalom, the Salam Rebbe, says that you can break down those 3 as symbolizing Torah is thoughts, our seichel. Avodah, which is either sacrifices or prayer, represents the emotion, the regesh, the feeling. And the gemilas chasadim, the acts of kindness, represent the mitzvot that have to do with pu'ulos, with actions. So you have your thoughts, your behaviors, and your emotions. And he says that al shlosh dvar ma'olam omid, the world stands on all these things. And the world, not just the big macro world, but on a micro level, our own world, our own selves, are based on these three things: on Torah, on Avoda, and Gemilas Chasadim, on our thoughts, on our emotions, and our behaviors. And in the left-hand column, you can read it inside on your own, he says that, like in CBT, he doesn't quote CBT, but like in CBT, these three things interact with each other. That when we talk about Seichel, Seichel is obviously impacted by our regesh, so our thoughts are impacted by our emotions, and they all impact each other in a dynamic fashion, each one interchanging, reciprocally affecting each other. So the thoughts lead to the emotions lead to the behaviors lead to the emotions, behaviors lead to thoughts, etc., and on and on and on and on. So why do we care? Right, so why do I care about my thoughts? Why do I care about my emotions? Why do I care about my behaviors? If we look at tshuva as a process, there's a few models that we can look at tshuva as. So what is tshuva? So tshuva you can look at as, I did a sin, I have to correct the sin. So I said Lashon Hara, I have to stop saying Lashon Hara. I didn't go to davening, now I have to go to davening. Another way of looking at tshuva is more of on a relationship level. How is my relationship with God? Is the way that I'm acting on a daily basis, am I in tune to God? Do I feel close to God? And tshuva is a process of returning to God. So there's more of the focusing on the mitzvos, the averos. There's more of focusing on the relationship. And then the question becomes, so where do my emotions, where do my thoughts, where do my behaviors come into that? So I understand behaviors to some extent. Right? Don't say Lashon Hara, that's a behavior. But if we take a step back, we realize that all of, for the most part, lots of the mitzvos that we think about, and even our relationship with Hashem, is tied directly to how we're thinking and how we're feeling. Our emotions and our thoughts are going to impact both my behaviors of mitzvos as well as my relationship with God. Just to bring that out a little bit more clearly, look at source number two. So the Rambam says, you might think that, as Rambam and Hilchos Tshuva, you might think that tshuva is just for specific averos, specific sins, actions. You stole something, you do tshuva for it. It says that's an imprecise and incorrect formulation of what tshuva is. It's not full. Al tomar she'ein tshuva elam averos she'esh ben maisa, kegon znus v'gezel v'gneva. Tshuva is not just about things that have actions, behaviors. Just like you do have to do tshuva for these actions, tshuva, repentance applies to our emotions, to anger. Not just about, does my anger lead to a sin? Regardless of if it leads to a classical taryag mitzvah sin, my midos, my character, the way I am inside, my personality, there is a proper Torah personality and there's an improper Torah personality. So if I am somebody who loves taiva, who loves eating, as one of his examples, and we'll get to this later on, machal, redifos hamachalos, all I do is I love eating and I love the gashmias and I love the physicality, that even if I don't commit a sin per se, that is still something that I have to do tshuva for. And even if I keep my anger inside and I don't express it and I don't break anything and I don't yell at anybody and I don't have people who are very upset at me because of my anger, usually that doesn't happen. Usually if I feel angry, even inside, people notice and people realize and it does affect relationships. But even if you want to isolate that and say, I'm just angry inside, nobody else is impacted, I don't commit any sins, the Rambam says, you still have to do tshuva. That anger is a problem. Your midos, your character, is a problem. So when we look at our thoughts, our emotions, our behaviors, the therapy process of CBT is going to help us, especially with not just action-based tshuva, but character-based tshuva. These are things to know. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? How am I behaving? And is it following a Torah lifestyle, not on a limited mitzvah sense, but on a broader personality sense? Flip the page. To part two. So we're going to do now, I spend a few moments giving you examples from Torah concepts of the CBT triangle. We're going to focus first in part two on how thoughts lead to emotions, and then in part three on behaviors lead to emotions. So in terms of thoughts leading to emotions, the way I think is going to impact the way that I feel inside. The famous example of this, we've quoted in the past, is the Ibn Ezra. I didn't quote to you the Ibn Ezra here. I'll just say briefly outside. The Ibn Ezra says, how can it be that the Torah commands us not to covet? Lo sachmod. Don't feel that you want something that somebody else has. Don't desire it. It's theirs. It's not yours. How can the Torah tell us what to feel? So Ibn Ezra says that many people ask this question. Torah can't command emotions, and somebody recently came to me in shul, saw my CBT triangle, and said, how can you say that you can control your emotions? How can you change your emotions? Emotions just happen to you. And the essence of CBT is that that is false, and that our emotions can, if we realize it, be changed by changing the way we think and changing the way that we behave. So in terms of thoughts leading to the emotions, Ibn Ezra says, the Torah tells us you have to feel this way. You cannot covet somebody else's stuff. How can I feel it? It's my emotion. Don't tell me what to feel. Well, Ibn Ezra says, how do you change the way you feel? He says, change the way you think. If you work on internalizing the concept that what he has, God gave to him, and it has absolutely nothing to do with you, and what you have is what God gave to you, and it has nothing to do with him, and if you really internalize that thought, then you will be able to not feel that you want what he has. And not an easy thing to do, but for our purposes now, changing the way we think in the Ibn Ezra is going to change the way and impact the way that we feel. So that's the classic example. I came across these two more examples that I think are fascinating. Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, Rosh Yeshiva YU, just gave a shiur recently on a related topic, not from a therapeutic perspective or a psychological perspective, but he quoted these two sources, which I believe are fascinating. One is Rabbeinu Bachaye of the Karachemach, source number 3. He says as follows. His tshuva needs 4 conditions. Ha'ech, we're not going to go through all 4, but the first one is ha'echad shi'azav achet bein v'maisa bein v'machshava. You have to stop sinning, both in terms of action and in terms of thinking. Hu shehanavi tzavach, Yishayahu says, yazav rasha darko, zeo ha'maisa. In Yishayahu, we say some fast days. Remove yourself from your path. That is talking about stopping the action. But then Yeshayahu continues, V'ish aven machshavosav. A man who is sinning has to stop, a woman who is sinning, thinking that way as well. Zeu machshava. Now watch where I bolded and italicized here. Lefi sheyesh kama b'nei adam, shem svurim she'ein to'elas v'hefzed b'machshava salev, kim b'dibor b'poel. It says there's a lot of people who think, it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't. What matters? What I do. What I do. V'davar yadua ki ikar simchas haguf v'tzaro t'luyim belibo. He says, it is well known, at least to him, not to the people who said this isn't true, but it is well known to him, and it is well known to CBT, and it is well known to cognitive sciences, that the way you think is going to influence, if not directly impact in totality, the way that your emotional experiences are made up. So the way you think is going to influence how happy you are. The way you think is going to influence how depressed you are. The way you think is essential. So somebody who is sinning needs to not just stop the behavior, but needs to stop the thinking. Even perhaps more powerfully, look in source number 4, the Meiri, says as follows. The first line, V'chein bal machshava ra'a, lo yargish mitzad she'eno ose maise avera, v'hihi ha'meviyaso leguf avera. He says there's some people who are doing actions and they're not worried, so worried about their thoughts. But what they don't realize is that it's the thoughts that are leading to the avera. The way I'm thinking is going to influence directly my actions. Thoughts lead to emotions. Thoughts lead to behaviors. It's clear within the Meiri, Rabbeinu Bachya, Ibn Ezra, etc., etc., etc. This is a fundamental point when it comes to mitzvos. It's a fundamental point here when it comes to tshuva. On the flip, and we'll get to practically how this works in a moment, but on the flip, part 3, how do our behaviors impact our emotions? So the way we behave is going to impact the way we feel. So the famous source for this is source number 5. I gave it to you here. It's the Sefer Achinuch. Sefer HaChinuch wrote a sefer writing down all of the mitzvos in the Torah, and he goes and he gives you an explanation both in terms of some of the laws of the mitzvos as well as the importance, the shorashim of the mitzvos and the reason, the tam of the mitzvah. Why do we perform this mitzvah? And here in Parshas Bo, when the Torah is really starting to give you, it's where through Bereishis, you don't have that many mitzvos. It's starting in Sefer Shmos, where you start with Korban Pesach, start having a lot of mitzvos start coming up. Right? So when he's starting to talk about all of these mitzvos, you talk about the mitzvos of Pesach, there's dozens of them, and there's even more that we're not really familiar with because we don't have the sacrifices. But if we had the sacrifices, there would be more and more and more and more mitzvos. So Sefer HaChinuch basically asks something that maybe we've all been troubled by. It's like, why are there so many of them? Right? Why do you care so much about what I do? Why? You want me to be a good person? I'll be a good person. But 613? Okay, some of them are about being a good person. But this, I can't eat this way on the Pesach. I can't break the bone on the Korban Pesach. I have to eat it before this time. I have to do this. There's so many. Why are there so many? And what's the purpose of all of these actions? So his whole thesis for this mitzvah in particular, but more broadly in other mitzvahs as well, he says as follows, where I just, for the sake of time, we're not going to read the whole thing. Look where I bolded and italicized in the middle of the sheet. The right-hand column is the Hebrew, the left is the English taken from Sfarya.org. So he says, duh, so I'm halfway through where it's bolded and italicized, duh, ki ha'adam nifal kefi pu'ulasa. Know that people are act and people feel and people are impacted by their actions. The libo, and lev here means both in terms of the emotional experience as well as the thought process, even though we've given shiurim on this in the past, when we think lev, we think heart, we think emotions. In Chazal and in Rishonim, lev generally means thoughts as well as emotions. It's not one or the other. So the libo b'chol machshavasov, he says it explicitly, your heart and all of your thoughts, tamid, Acher Masav Shehu Osebehem. Your thoughts are completely based on your actions. The way you behave is going to impact the way you think. And therefore, he says, we have all these mitzvos. The mitzvos are there, and you have to go through each one to see how this is true. But the mitzvos are there to impact our behaviors, our actions are there to impact the way that we're thinking and feeling inside. And each one has a something that we should be thinking and feeling towards God, towards somebody else. Okay, and then he finishes off the paragraph here, bolded and italicized, ki acharei ha'pu'ulos nimshachem halavavos. Those are the famous words. But it is known and true that every man is acted upon according to his actions, as we have seen. Acharei ha'pu'ulos, our actions influence, are impacted, impact our lavavos, our mind, our heart, our mindset. So our behaviors lead to our emotions. So how is that going to impact, let's just go from a therapeutic standpoint for a second, how is that going to impact a therapy? So let's say somebody's depressed. So when I'm depressed, what do I feel like? I feel like staying in bed. I feel like not moving. I feel like staying still. How do I get out of that? So one of the first steps in depression is behavioral activation. It's go do stuff. Right? Because if you stay in bed, and this is very hard to do because every fiber in your being is telling you to stay in bed, right? But the first step is to try as hard as you can to go out and do stuff. Because when you start doing stuff, then acharei ha'pu'ulos nimshachem halavavos. Through those actions, then you start getting a little bit lighter, you start moving a little bit more, your mind starts shifting, your thoughts start shifting, because the actions are going to impact the way that you feel. The Mesilas Yesharim says this in source number 6, not talking about depression, but in terms of a religious personality, he says, the third line towards the end, where it's again bolded and italicized, he says, ki atnua hachitzona me'oreres ha'penimis. The outside actions, the way that we externally behave, are going to impact the way that we feel inside. And he says, if you want to know where to start working, if you want to change your inside, then don't start with the inside, because it's very hard to change the inside. Start with the outside, start with the externals. And here in the context, he's talking about Zrizos doing things with zeal and passion. He says, so sometimes I don't feel zeal and passion. I don't feel like I want to do it. I'm not in the mood. Well, the goal is to, despite the fact that you're not in the mood, to to get up, get moving, because that's going to impact the way that we feel inside and hopefully shift it towards a more positive and energetic mindset. The Rambam here in source number 7, so one more example of this, the Rambam says when it comes to changing our character, this is a concept in therapy called opposite action. If you want to change my character, you go to the opposite extreme, total opposite extreme, in order to eventually, as the Rambam states it, get back to the middle. But if I'm on one extreme, then my goal is to do behaviors in the exact opposite extreme to get eventually to the middle. Look at how he formulates it inside. Go to the end of the source. You can read the beginning on your own. End of the source, the 4 lines from the bottom where it's, again, bolded and italicized. If I'm on one extreme, go over and over and over again to the exact opposite extreme until eventually I calibrate towards the middle. And some of the examples that he gives, if you read it on, we'll do a little bit from the beginning in the English. So he says, how are they to be healed? We tell from the beginning of the source 7, we tell the wrathful man to train himself to feel no reaction, even if he is beaten or cursed. So go to the, that's an extreme. Usually if I'm beaten or cursed, I could react. It's appropriate to react. But we start off, he says, by not reacting even to extreme situations. He should follow this course of behavior for a long time until the anger is uprooted from his heart. The man who is full of pride should cause himself to experience much disgrace. In REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy, which we'll talk about soon, this is called a shame attack. Right? So if you feel like you're so either that people are going to judge me, people are going to I don't want to go do anything because people are going to be making fun of me, people are going to laugh at me, I'm going to be embarrassed. So the shame attack is go do that, get embarrassed, and then realize that you're okay. You didn't die. In this other extreme example is that if I'm, Barbara, just hold the questions for now, please. If I'm arrogant, so go do something that's going to put you down. Go get made fun of. Go let somebody step on you. I don't know, literally or figuratively. But okay, then go to that extreme. This needs to be calibrated with help if you're, you know, have low self-esteem, don't do that. But again, this is somebody who's arrogant. This is something to do, to go to the other extreme in order to work on that arrogance. So again, this is called opposite action. Go to the other extreme to recalibrate at some point in the middle. So for now, just to recap what we've had until this point, we have the... Actually, before we recap, one more source. Flip, go to the third page, source number 8. It's from the Torah Avram of Avon Bloch. Is a Musar Sefer from the past century, where he basically says what we've been saying in the Rambam and in the Mesillas Yesharim, to say that when it comes to working on ourselves, there's sometimes where I underlined here, Dvarim Elu Morim Ki Ein Dai B'Maisim Levad L'Takinas Amidos. Behaviors aren't always enough. To change the behavior is part of the work. But what else do I need? Rak B'Tzarfu Z'Avodas HaMachshava Gamkin. I also have to change the thoughts. Right, so if we want to change, we have to look at our thoughts, we have to look at our behaviors, and we have to analyze them all in order to get general, authentic, long-lasting change. If I just focus on the behaviors but I don't focus on the thought, it's not going to change. As we'll see also, if I don't focus on the emotion, and the emotion is involved, then I'm also going to have a hard time changing. So we're going to have to analyze the thoughts, we're going to have to analyze the emotions, we're going to have to analyze the behaviors, because all of these together are integrate in order to create who we are and what we do. And because of that, if we want to do tshuva, we have to keep all of these in mind. Okay, so unless it's a desperate question, I'd rather hold it, just because we got a lot to do. If you can hold it to the end, I know you want to, and I want to hear it too, but let's just hold it. Write it down, and we'll take questions at the end. Okay, so part 4. Right under the source we just finished, part 4. So we're going to take a sidestep tangent for a few moments, just because this is really important. We identified the thoughts, emotions, and behaviors component of CBT, but in the background of CBT, there's two components to it, free will and personal responsibility, two really important concepts that are essential to CBT and essential to tshuva, and that is that A, we are in control of what we do. If I think that I am not in control. My genetics are in control. How my parents treated me when I was a child are in control. How my spouse is treating me now, how my friends, etc., are what is determining my own thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. There's some truth to that, but if you want to change, you got to take that responsibility on yourself to change. We can look for social support, we can try to get help, and we can try, all that's great, but at the end of the day, it's going to come down to me taking responsibility for myself to realize that I am the one that can change. And two sources that bring this out, look in source number 9, the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva says, there's a lot of words here, but we'll just summarize the main important parts over here. He starts off the first text box, Rishus kol adam nesuna, im ratza lahatos asma l'derach tova, lios sadik rishus biyado, im ratza lahatos asma l'derach ra, lios rasha rishus biyado. The Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva, because free will is essential to change, says that we have the choice to be good or to be bad. It's in our hands. And then in the next text box, Al yavor b'machshavascha davar zesh omrim tipshei umosa olam v'rov golmei b'nei Yisrael. The Rambam sometimes has strong formulations of other people who disagree with him. He says, don't even consider what all of these not very smart people, both Jews, non-Jews, think. What do they think? Third line, Shakarish Baruch Hu gozer al adam mitchilas briyasa liosadik or rasha. And this is a very popular idea nowadays as well, that you're, whether or not you're going to be good or bad is determined by God, or in scientific terms, we'll say it's determined by your genetics. Whether you're good or bad is depend not up to you. Oh, adavar ein adavar kein ela kol adam roi liosadik kimosar rabenu or rasha ki ravam. Everything, your whole personality, he's probably overstating some aspects of this to some extent, but he says your whole personality is totally in your hands. You can do what you want. Again, that's overstated, and I think he would agree it's overstated in other places. He takes a step back from, again, there are genetic limitations that we have. Those, that is true. I cannot, and I'm a firm believer in this, when we try to build our children or ourselves or other people up to pretend that we can do whatever we want to do if we just put our mind to it. It's not exactly true, and we have to be realistic within our own cognitive, emotional, and you know, life circumstance limitations. We do have limitations, but as a broad point, it's still true, right? We have control over a lot, if not most, if not 99% of what how we feel and what we think and what we do. It might take a lot of time, maybe a lifelong work dedicated to trying to get there, but we could get there to take that that control of our bodies, of our lives, of our minds, and our souls. And the Rambam just continues and he says, if you don't say this, there's really no point of Torah, right? What the Torah is saying, do mitzvos, don't do averos. And if your mindset is, well, I can't control myself, I have no control, it's all determined by God, he did, okay, so then you just deleted, you know, the whole point of Torah. And the Rambam, that's not the only reason why it's false, but it's a big question to say, I don't have control, but you're still responsible. There's still scharva onesh. You know, you're still punished and rewarded for what you do. Okay, so flip the page to source number 10, and this story is a powerful story. It's going to bring home the point, and then we'll move on to some practical strategies. So this is a very powerful story in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. It's PG-13/rated R. We'll skip the gory details, but there was this guy who was named Elazar ben Dordaya. As the Gemara calls him, it's Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, and as we'll see towards the end of the story, that he wasn't always a rabbi. And he didn't get smicha from an institution. But you'll see what I'm talking about. So this guy, Elazar ben Dordaya, we'll keep it PG-13, did many, many sins in very powerful, extreme ways. You can read it on your own, scan it if you want. But he did lots of really bad things, and he was known as the guy who did lots of really bad things. Then one day, again, part of the story is can't say inappropriate because it's a Gemara, but in this setting right now, I'm not going to go through it. But something, some interchange happened at some point with another person in the room who he shouldn't have been with, where he then had this realization, sort of a smack in the face, like, what in the world am I doing? Right? What am I doing with my life? How am I sinning all of this time? So now let's pick up where it's now rated G. So it's around in the English, it's the second paragraph. In the Hebrew, it's around 15. The Aramaic, excuse me, it's around 15 lines down or so. So he says, this woman says to him, "You're never going to be able to do tshuva." So now he says, again, around 15 lines down in the Aramaic, English, second paragraph. Halach v'yashav bein shnei harim v'gvoth. He sat in between, in this moment of reflection, between mountains and two mountains and hills, and said, I'm just going to read from the English to save time, "Mountains and hills, pray for mercy on my behalf so that my repentance will be accepted." They said to him, "Before we pray for mercy on your behalf, we must pray for mercy on our own behalf. As it is stated," and it quotes a pasuk, that they have to save themselves. The mountains are only worried about themselves. For the mountains may depart and the hills be removed. So he said, "Heaven and earth, pray for mercy on my behalf." They said to him, "Before we pray for mercy on your behalf, we have to pray for ourselves. So we've got to take care of ourselves first. For the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax old like a garment." The next paragraph. He said, "Sun and moon, pray for mercy on my behalf." They said to him, "Before we pray for mercy on your behalf, we must pray for mercy on our behalf." And then continues, he said to the stars and the constellations, "Pray for mercy on my behalf." They said to him, "We have to pray for mercy on our behalf first." So now, next paragraph. Elazar ben Dordaya said, "Clearly the matter depends on nothing other than myself." In the Aramaic, very powerful words, "Ein hadavar talui ella bi." It is up to me. I can't look to everybody else, to the entire world, to blame, to help me, to daven for me. It's up to me. Personal responsibility to do tshuva. And so what does he do? He placed his head between his knees and cried loudly until his soul left his body. That was his tshuva. A divine voice emerged and said, "Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya is destined for the life in the world to come." How did he get the world to come? He did all these terrible sins. But since he did tshuva in that moment, not only he gets the world to come. Look at the next paragraph. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi hears his story. He wept and said, "There is one who acquires his share in the world to come only after many years of toil. And there is one who acquires his share in the world to come in one moment. Yesh kona olamo b'sha'ah achas." In one moment, Elazar ben Dordaya got his tshuva. Now, I don't recommend this as practice, you know, to do this, you know, lechatchila, for this should be your mindset at the out, you know, from the start. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi then says, and he hammers it home even more, not only are penitents accepted, but they're even called rabbi. He's called Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, just from the fact that he finally realized that the tshuva was up to me, and he did the tshuva, and then he his soul departed, and then he got Olam Haba for his tshuva. Very powerful story, highlighting the points of personal responsibility. Eina davar tuli ella bi. It's up to me. I have the power, the free will, to choose to act and to think and to feel differently than the way that I feel now. It might be hard. It might take lots of work. And there might be some exceptions to that rule. But as a general statement, I can take control. So let's now go to some practical strategies. Go to part 5. So now we're gonna intertwine the therapeutic sources as well with some of the Torah sources, with the eye on more practical strategies at this point. So to start off, I alluded to this in the intro to the Torah over Rosh Hashanah. We really need to understand better, both in terms of what emotions we're talking about, what thoughts we're talking about, and see that there's different categories of feeling and there's different categories of thinking. So we're going to start with emotions. And we're going to frame this discussion between healthy and unhealthy emotions. Notice I didn't say positive and negative emotions. Right? There are things such as positive emotions, happiness, excitement, exuberance, love, all that stuff. I'm going to put that away for a different shiur. Right? Usually people, at least coming to therapy, and even when it comes to tshuva, we're dealing more with negative parts, right? So positive, let's put to the side for a different point in time. For now, we're going to focus on negative emotions, but we have to distinguish, and this might be an unfamiliar concept to some, between healthy negative emotions and unhealthy negative emotions. Meaning, there is a goal to being able to experience emotions in a healthy negative way. We tend to like to run away from negative emotions. We don't like to feel anything negative, so we avoid them. And what's essential in therapy, and I think essential for an accurate and complete religious life, is we need to learn how to deal healthily with negative emotions. We'll see the way to get to a healthy negative emotion is to change the way we think and to change the way we behave. But first we have to delineate what's a healthy and what's an unhealthy negative emotion. So look at this little chart you have here. This is from a website called CCBT, where it distinguishes between, on the left-hand column is healthy negative emotions, the right-hand is unhealthy negative emotions, and in the middle is the general belief that can lead to either the healthy negative or the unhealthy negative. So to give you some examples, let's do the first line over here. On the left-hand side, your healthy negative emotion is concern. On the right-hand side, your unhealthy negative emotion we'll call anxiety. So just to give an example, it says here that the concept, the situation, is a perceived threat or danger to self. So the example I usually give when I communicate this is, let's say you have a test coming up. So if you have a test that's in a week, to say, I don't want to feel anything, or I want to feel positive about this test that I have up in the upcoming week, is usually for most people not realistic. When we have a test, we're going to feel some level of negativity. That negativity can be good. If it's a concern, it keeps me focused. I don't want to do badly on this test. This test is really important for my life. So I want to focus. I want to study. I want to make sure that I don't get distracted by other things. So I have some level of low, healthy, negative emotion that's motivating me towards a goal of studying for the test. If that emotion was unhealthy, let's call it anxiety, then I will be so distracted by the fear that I have about this test that I won't be able to study, I won't be able to concentrate, I'll avoid opening my books, I'll procrastinate, and I'll push it off, and then I probably won't do so well on the test. So an unhealthy negative emotion moves us away from our goals, away from what we want to accomplish. A healthy negative emotion is good. We want it because it helps move us towards a positive direction. A few more examples. The next line. Sadness versus depression. If somebody experiences a loss or a failure, it's appropriate and healthy to feel sad. Sadness has a function. It can signal to our friends that we could use some social support. It can also help us reflect that we're not accomplishing the goals that we want. If I have a goal and I don't accomplish it, I feel sad. That's great. Your body is telling you, try to fix it. So if you go then to try to fix it, that's a healthy negative emotion that leads to a positive consequence, an adaptive behavior of fixing the problem if it's fixable. If I'm depressed, on the other hand, then my emotion is unhealthy, and instead of trying to solve the problem, instead of trying to get help or support from other people, I will, as we stated before, probably stay in bed and do behaviors that are not helping the situation and not trying to change it. So healthy leads to the goal, leads to adaptive behaviors. Unhealthy, not so much. The same is true for annoyance and anger, but let's go to the next one, remorse and guilt, because this is essential for tshuva. Tshuva, I do something wrong. So there are those that will tell you, don't focus on negatives, just focus on positive. Focus on how great you are. Focus on all the qualities that you have. You did something wrong, don't focus on that. It's not good for you. It's not healthy for you. So I will argue to you that that is false, both from a psychological perspective as well as from a religious perspective. Now, it might be true for some people, right? If I'm in an unhealthy style, then it could be that I have to go to the opposite extreme to try to be more positive. It doesn't always work that way. But I want to, before we get to exceptions to the rule, the general rule as I understand it, both from a therapeutic and religious perspective, is if I do something wrong, I want to be feeling guilt, right? Guilt, well, let's call it here remorse. Let's call it remorse. It's semantics what you call it, so it doesn't really matter. You want to feel a healthy negative emotion that, let's call it remorse, that I did something wrong. Because when I feel remorse that I do something wrong, that is my body telling me, try to repair, try to fix it, try not to do it again. I don't want to avoid that feeling. I want that feeling. That's what tshuva is. Tshuva is I do something wrong, I feel bad about it in a healthy way, and then I try to go fix it. If I process it in an unhealthy negative way, and I feel, let's call it, an unhealthy guilt. And how do I know it's unhealthy? Because A, it's so distressful. It feels so painful. B, most importantly, I'm not actually fixing it. I'm so stuck in my self-pity, and I'm stuck in not being able to move forward, that makes it an unhealthy negative emotion. But again, I want that healthy negative emotion. I want to feel remorse, or I want to feel, you know, disappointment or regret, etc. If you go down the list, you can read the rest on your own. So to set up the starting point is, I want to feel a healthy negative emotion when something doesn't go the way that I want it to go, but I want to avoid feeling an unhealthy emotion. How do I get from a unhealthy emotion to a healthy emotion? So that's going to largely depend on the way I'm thinking, and we'll get to that in a few moments. Just for one, I think, powerful source that I think proves what I'm saying from a religious perspective, although I'm not sure I need this from a religious perspective to say. I think what I'm saying is pretty firm. But you have one interesting source here, source number 12, The Quest for Authenticity, the thought of Simcha Bunim of Peshitsa from Michael Rosen. It's a great book. Where he talks about depression, and he writes as follows. Hasidism draws a distinction between two qualities which might at first glance appear to be similar. There is controlled self-analysis that brings with it a certain bitterness, a reflective sorrow when one realizes that one was unable to respond, a sense of missed opportunity. This is positive, right? We want to feel that. We want to feel bad when we do something that's not right. However, there is an alternative type of brokenness that leads to despair. The distinction is between, on the one hand, controlled bitterness of the one who recognizes that he is flawed, and on the other hand, a sense of despair that leads to resignation, apathy, and hopelessness. That's our healthy versus unhealthy emotion. When it comes to tshuva and self-analysis, it's not, oh, I can't analyze myself. I can't know what I'm thinking or doing or behaving because I'm going to get too scared and too depressed, and therefore I only have to think about the positives. No. In a controlled, healthy manner, look at your negatives, feel bad about them, and try to fix them. That's the goal. Right? Is that clear? So now, if you want more on healthy versus unhealthy emotions, just to save time, I didn't give you a dozen sources, but I gave you some Mari Makomos here of places where I've spoken about this or written about it in the past. We covered this in Pirkei Avos. If you look right under source number 12, where there's two arrows, we covered it in Pirkei Avos, Shir 89, we talked about healthy anxiety. And then in Shir 58, we talked about the power of negative emotions. So you can go on yutorah.org and read more about that if you want. Okay, so healthy versus unhealthy emotions. Now, how do we get the healthy versus unhealthy emotions? So we're going to look at our behaviors, and we're going to look at our thoughts. Okay, so first, even though I think thoughts should come first, just for the sake of momentum, we're going to start with behaviors in part 6, behavioral strategies. So as we go through this, and hopefully we have time at the end to do this a case study to put this into play, but as we go through this, see how you can perhaps implement this into your own change strategies into what you want to do and fix over this time of the year. So number one strategy is called self-monitoring. Okay, so this is explicit in the Maseilas Yesharim. I wrote about it in the Psych for Torah on the bottom of the page. You'll see the reference there. You can look at about it more on your own. But Chazal were very into cheshbon, cheshbon ha-nefesh, taking accounting, being aware of what you're doing. not just doing things mindlessly, taking out a notebook, taking out a diary, and keeping track of what you're thinking, keeping track of what you're doing. And in CBT, this is one of the first things you're going to be doing. If you're trying to change a behavior or changing an emotion, you got to keep track. So you take out your diary, you take out your phone, and they have apps for this, and you write down, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? What's my behavior? If you're not tracking it, if you're not monitoring it, it's going to be very, very, very hard, almost impossible to change anything. So the first step, behavioral strategy, is to start changing, but start tracking. So you can read that in source number 13 in Maseilas Yesharim. Source number 14 is a great book called Jewish Spiritual Practices by a rabbi by the name of Yitzchak Buxbaum, where he quotes and translates. It's a 700 or 800 page book. He compiles various different eitzas, various different strategies that you find in Sfarim, whether it's Hasidus Sfarim, Musar Sfarim, in terms of what ways to exercise, to practice, to improve that are found. So one of the things that he talks about here is that you should write the main hanhagos that are necessary for you at the time, for the particular character trait you are laboring to fix, on a small piece of paper. For example, for anger, you might write silence and speak in a low voice. If you want to write them so that others will not be able to read it, then write it in signs and hints. The little notepaper should be before you or in your hand at all times. Continually look at it and read it with renewed feeling and determination to be careful about everything there. To start being mindful, keeping track, looking out to see what my goal is for the day, and to keep tracking it. You flip the page. So I'm just for the we're going to spend more time on the thoughts. For the behaviors, they're important but easier to understand, so we're going to do them a little bit quicker. So number 15 is another strategy, pros and cons list, cost-benefit analysis. It's called different things in different therapies. Here's from the DBT, Dialectical Behavior Therapy Skills Manual, where you can make a pros and cons list of acting on a specific urge. So I'm going to write the pro of acting on the urge. I'm going to write the con of acting on the urge. I'm going to write the pro of resisting the urge. And I'm going to write the con about resisting the urge. And I'm going to look at that and think about it. Right, so we're not denying the fact that sometimes there's a positive, there's a benefit that comes from me doing something that's wrong or bad. So I'm gonna write that. And I'm gonna try to balance that with, well, this doesn't fit with my overall goals in life, it doesn't fit with my values. So by putting it on a sheet of paper, it's very powerful. It's hard to do in the moment, but it's very powerful. By putting it on a sheet of paper and looking at it, and you're able to weigh, do I want to do this? Do I not want to do this? Because usually when we act impulsively, we're not thinking. We're not weighing. We're not thinking about consequences. Here's a way, a strategy to just put it down on a sheet of paper, write it down to weigh the pros and cons. And we spoke about this in Pirkei Avos, Shir 44, cost-benefit analysis. One more strategy, source number 16, stimulus control. For this, I just gave you four other sources you can look at, where the basic idea of stimulus control is that oftentimes we try to change our behavior, we try to change the way we think, we try to change the way we feel, and we work really hard on building our self-control, but the easiest and best and most effective strategy a lot of times is to not put ourselves in that situation in the first place, right? So if I'm struggling with something, avoid the battle. Don't go there. Don't create a Yetzer Hara battle if you can just walk in a different direction. Right? So that's called stimulus control. You set up your house. You set up, this is for those teachers, if you have a problem with a child in class. So usually the best strategy is not to try to fight them head on. It's to move their seat, right? And now they're not talking to that person next to them because they don't like the new person they're talking to. So they're quiet, sitting over there. You just change the whole situation without a complete, you know, overhaul of your personality and the child's personality. You change the situation, oftentimes that can fix the problems, avoid the battle. That's stimulus control, situational control. It's called a few different things in different places. We talked about it. There's a psych, two psych for Torahs on it, as well as two Pirkei Avoses where we related to it. Source number 17, another strategy. Use behavioral strategies of reward and punishment to incentivize and to punish behaviors. So if you want to increase a positive behavior, reward yourself for it. Right? If I do this action that I want to do, if I go to Minyan in the morning, if I learn this thing, if I do this chesed, I am going to buy myself X, Y, and Z. Sometimes we think about this as a strategy that we just use for kids, because we're adults and I can just buy it anyway. But if you're able to create a system where you reward yourself only when you do that thing that you don't want to do, then you can use rewards in a positive way to increase the likelihood that you're going to have that behavior. And then on the flip side, you can punish bad behavior. So if you do something that is inappropriate or something you don't want to do, give money to tzedakah, or give money to a tzedakah that you hate, or give money to the opposite. Or if I did this in yeshiva, it helped me control the way I was talking in terms of nivel pel, not like real bad cursing, but just even the way I use language, is that anytime I said something I didn't want to say, I gave a dollar to tzedakah. You don't even know, if you've never done it before, you don't even realize how powerful of a strategy it is, because A, not that I care that much about the dollar, but I'm now mindful of it, and I'm aware of it, and I'm cognizant of it, and I'm monitoring it, because I don't want to not give the money to tzedakah if I owe the money to tzedakah, so I'm going to be careful of it, and then I'm going to stop doing it, and then if I get a week where I don't say something I don't want to say, I can give money to tzedakah anyway. But again, the punishment that can come from doing something you don't want to do is a very powerful technique. There's a website, I've referred to it in the past, it's called stick.com, S-T-I-C-K-K. It was put together by a psychologist from Yale University, where the whole website is based on this idea, is that you can set up a system of punishments for yourself if you don't follow through on a goal of yours. And they'll hold you to the punishment. So I'm sure you can trick the system, but they'll hold you to, if I don't do this, then this money that I've already put in your website will go to this political party that I despise. And then you're monitored. And they do use another element, which we'll get to in a second. But that's a very, very powerful way. Reward and punishing behaviors. It's not just for kids. We can use it for ourselves as well. Source number 18. Right. You could very good point, Shalani. Even for yourself and your kids, giving yourself compliments. Sometimes we think of reinforcers. We think just in terms of candy or money or something. Giving yourself or your children or your grandchildren praise is a very powerful, probably even more powerful form of reinforcement than money and toys and games. So saying I'm proud of you, say I'm proud of myself, those are things that increase your likelihood that you will do these things over and over again. Another strategy, I know we're going through these quickly, source number 18. These are distress tolerance skills from the dialectical behavior therapy. And these are really powerful. The ones we've done until this point are sort of like you're cool, you're calculated, you're planning for the future, you're trying to set up your system in advance for how you want to behave. These are strategies to deal with in-the-moment urges or in-the-moment distress, where I'm overwhelmed and I'm fighting that, you want to call it the Yetzer Hara, really strongly. I'm activated, if you will. These are strategies to help you calm down in order that you don't act on those urges and then eventually regret whatever it is that you did. So on the left-hand side of source 18, you have what's called stop. So stop, don't react, stay in control, take a step back, take a deep breath, don't act impulsively, observe what are you feeling or thinking, what are others saying or doing, right? So I'm being more mindful of my surroundings, it's taking me out of the current urge moment, and then proceed mindfully. Think about your goals and actions, and then you could put in the pros and cons in there. You could, right, you can move yourself from the situation, but stopping and working on stopping in these situations is essential. And then on the right-hand side, another DBT tip is called TIP, T-I-P-P, right? So number one is temperature. Change your body temperature using cold water or ice. This helps. Go put your face in ice-cold water, it'll change your state, your physiological state. If you're in a state of hotness, if you will, that I really, really want to do this, and you put your face in cold water, it's going to help you break out of it. Go take a cold shower, it's going to help you break out of it. The second one, intense exercise. Walk quickly, climb the stairs, jump up and down, run on the spot, just do it. You feel an urge, just go, start going like this, and it's going to help reorient your body away from the hot state that you're in. Deep breathing, paced breathing is important. You can do, for those who want to learn how to do deep breathing, it's a very important skill. Just Google, go to YouTube and search deep breathing or diaphragmatic breathing, watch a 5-minute YouTube video. It'll help you learn how to calm your body down in states of high stress. And then finally, paired muscle relaxation. This is a little bit more involved also, but you could go to YouTube. They have videos of muscle relaxation where you learn how to calm your body down. I'll do one exercise with you briefly if you want. Take, for those who are daring to be embarrassed, nothing's going to happen. But if you lift your right hand and left hand doesn't matter, make a muscle as hard as you can for 10 seconds. Now let it go. Maybe you felt it, maybe you didn't, but that contrast between the tenseness of making the muscle and then the looseness of letting it go is a very powerful technique. If you do that when you're tense, when you're stressed, when you're anxious, and you keep and you do that throughout your entire body, again, there's YouTube videos that do this with you, you will feel your body calmer, more relaxed. You're letting go of the stress.
Don't you do that naturally to protect yourself?
But that's the problem. You don't let it go, right? You tense up, and then you stay tense. Right, but in order to practice the skill, we then practice letting it go. And then when we do this with kids, we call it the loose noodle. Because at the end, you feel like you're just like, you know, and that's very common. So those are tips for in the moment problem. So now let's, somebody give me a time. I'm totally.
26 minutes.
Okay. Listen, if anybody has to, I still want to go a little bit more. If anybody has to go, feel free. But I'm trying to condense, three shiurim into one here.
21 so, after, so.
Okay, 21 after. So if anybody needs to go, feel free. But I think at least if one person's here, I'll keep going. So part 7, we're going to go to cognitive strategies. Okay, so we just did a whole bunch of behavioral strategies. Hopefully some of them resonated with you, something you can take away with you going forward. Now let's think about changing the way we think. So in number 19, we won't do it inside, but just briefly, this is a very important concept. When we talk about the way we think and the way we talk about ourselves, it's essential to realize that nuances and semantics are important. The way we think is, even if it's a slightly different word that we're using, is going to have a tremendous impact on the way that we feel. In philosophy, it's called general semantics theory. It was created by somebody called Alfred Korzybski. I mean, it has things that go back and traces in Chazal and earlier philosophies as well. But it's the basis of rational emotive behavior therapy is based on the fact that the way you're talking to yourself, the words that you use are going to impact the way you feel. And in source number 19, Rav Shlomo Zalman Dolinsky makes that same point in the Sefer Tenuas HaMusar. But for now, let's go to source number 20. So, when it comes to the way we're thinking, what CBT says, and there's different types of CBT, but we'll just lump them all together for now, is that when I think what we'll either call irrationally or think through cognitive distortions, incorrect, imprecise, illogical thinking styles will lead to emotional distress as well as behavioral problems. So if I'm thinking incorrectly, that's going to impact the way that I feel. So the goal of cognitive behavior therapy, is one of the goals besides for the behaviors in terms of the cognitive part, is to find what we're thinking, determine if it's logical or illogical, rational or irrational, and if it's not, if there's a problematic thinking style, we work on changing it to be more rational or more logically consistent. Because when I think rationally or I think logically, then my emotional health will be normal, healthy, and not unhealthy. My behaviors will be adaptive, helpful, not unhelpful or maladaptive. So to give you a few examples of styles of thinking that generally get people into trouble. Number one, if you look at source number 20, this is REBT, Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy. There's 4 irrational beliefs. This is the type of therapy that I do, and from my experience, I'm biased, but it always comes down to these one of these 4, if not a combination of them. If I think in terms of demandingness, that means things have to be a certain way. They must be a certain way. They need to, they ought to, they should be a certain way. Whether that's the world has to be a certain way, whether that's I have to behave a certain way, whether that's you have to behave a certain way, absolutely must, needs, have to, shoulds, demands, and then that thing doesn't happen. So you have to behave this way, and you don't, I will get an unhealthy emotion, anger. I have to behave this way, I must do this mitzvah, and I don't, depressed, unhealthy guilt. We want to change the way we're thinking from demands to preferences. I want to, I prefer to, it's my goal to, it's my value to. But there are literally, from the REBT perspective, nothing has to be anything. And when we tell ourselves that it needs to be, and then it's not, we will get unhealthy emotions that come out of that. And we'll talk about this perhaps a little bit later for more practical examples, but let's keep going for now. Another type of example, awfulizing. Things will be, are, or were in the past, 100% terrible, awful, catastrophic, end of the world. If I think that way, it will lead to anxiety if it's about the future. That if that thing happened, that will be 100% terrible, end of the world. I don't even know how I would survive such a situation. I will feel desperately anxious right now. About the past, I'll feel very depressed about something from the past. If I look at it as awful, terrible, catastrophic, end of the world. It's not denying that things are bad. Things could be bad. But there's a fundamental difference in semantics between me saying to myself, it's 99% bad versus 100% bad. And nothing is 100% bad. We could debate the philosophy of that at a different time, but let's go for that for now. Number three, global evaluations. This is a big one, especially when it comes to depression. I believe that people, including myself, can be rated based on global worth. You're a good person. You're a bad person. You're a terrible person. I am a smart person. I am a stupid person. I am a loser. I am worthless. I'm a failure. You're a loser. You're worthless. You're a failure. All of these things are global evaluations. They're irrational because nobody is a totality of anything. Everybody is more complex than one label. And if we label ourselves or other people, it's irrational. And when we do it, we will have an unhealthy emotion. So if I think I am worthless because I committed this sin, I will get depressed. And when I'm depressed, I'm not fixing the sin. That'll lead to an unhealthy emotion, and I'll wallow in my misery. So to think I failed, but I am not a failure, is essential for emotional health. If you're telling yourself you're worthless, you're a failure, you're nothing, that's dangerous, it's irrational. It will probably lead to depression, and it will lead to unhealthy tshuva. That's the tshuva you want to stay away from, because that's not going to lead to tshuva. That's going to lead to being stuck in your ways. If you can realize and distinguish between failing and being a failure, it's an essential point for life and specifically for tshuva. Finally, the last one here is frustration intolerance, believing that one cannot function in aversive circumstances. So these are when I tell myself thoughts along the lines of, I can't stand this. This is too much for me. I can't handle this. Whether I'm talking about a situation, I'm talking about another person, I'm talking about my emotional experience, it's just too much for me. I've had it. I'm done. I've had enough. We've all said this to ourselves, presumably. When we do, that will lead to an unhealthy emotion. We'll get angry. We get depressed. We get anxious, etc. It will probably lead to a non-helpful behavior. I'll yell at somebody. I'll ruin a relationship because I've just had enough. And the counter to this is that you haven't. You're telling yourself you had. You're creating an artificial cutoff in your brain that says, this much garbage I can handle, but this much I can't. After the third thing, I've had enough. Right? Two I could have handled. Three I can't deal. Who said? Who made that line? Who made that cutoff in your brain to say that much you can't handle? It's you. So the goal in therapy, and I think for Tshuva as well, is to realize it's a lot, but I can deal with it. There's never a cutoff of, I can't deal with this anymore. So these are four important cognitive irrational beliefs that lead to unhealthy emotions. We're going to skip number 21. They're cognitive distortions from a cognitive therapy perspective. It's a slightly different therapeutic outlook, but there's an overlap between the two. But just for the sake of time, we're going to skip them. I gave you some more sources on the bottom of the underneath source number 21 and various Pirkei Avos and Psych Torah things where we talked about related concepts. You know, we're going to need to do one of these. Go to 21, back in 21, where it says two. We'll do this quickly. Polarized thinking. Right, 21, two, polarized thinking or black and white thinking. And we're probably familiar with the concept. It's when it's either or thinking, right? It's either I'm awesome and amazing or I'm a failure and worthless, right? It's either I love you or I hate you. Right? There's no middle ground. We don't see gray. We don't see nuance. We don't see anything. And when we think in black and white, that's going to lead to various problems as well. Just keep that in mind as we finish up with the case study in a moment. Source number 22 is from Tnuas HaMusar. And it's just, we'll do it outside, but Rissol Salanter created the Musar movement. Basically, can give a whole shiur just on this concept. Is a tremendous overlap between the Musar movement and therapy from a number of perspectives. Number one is that the Musar movement, Rissol Salanter, was heavily influenced by the concept of the subconscious, which is not something we talk about that much in cognitive behavior therapy. That's more of a psychoanalytic Freudian concept. But he's very interested in the subconscious. That's one concept here. But the second concept, he was very interested in therapeutic techniques to get us to convince ourselves of various beliefs. And that's really what cognitive behavior therapy does, is that you have this belief, we just went through some of them, and now the avoda, if you will, the work is, how do I internalize these beliefs? How do these beliefs become part of me? And Rissol Salanter, from a non-therapeutic perspective, but from a religious perspective, was very into how do people start internalizing beliefs of anol milvado, God is one, there's nothing else besides him. Right? Or how else do I internalize other beliefs that are, you know, everything God does is, you know, has a purpose, right? So he was, yeah, I can think that, but I don't feel it. So the whole strategy of the Musar movement was to try to internalize these. And the strategies that he uses overlap tremendously with a bunch of cognitive behavior therapy techniques. Mainly, for our purposes now, is what we call coping statements. You're going to write down or think about what it is you're trying to internalize, whatever that belief is, that rational belief that you want. I failed, but I'm not a failure. You write that, you think it, you remind yourself of it over and over and over and over again. And you have to keep doing it. You can't just think it once. So you have to keep reminding yourself over and over and over and over again. Another thing Rissol Salanter says that we use in therapy as well is that sometimes even just thinking it is not enough. You have to put some oomph into it. You have to put some emotion, some evocative strategies, if you will, to get you to really get to your core of who you are. So it's one thing to just think it, but I want to make it a part of me. So how do I make it a part of me? So one of the strategies that he suggests, and Albert Ellis, who started REBT, used to do this a lot, is sing it. Sing it. Make a song out of that thought that you're trying to internalize. And by singing it, it goes, and for those who are into music, you get this, right? It goes farther in, if you will. It goes deeper into your brain if you can make it into a song. Or if you could put some emotion into it. You say, you know, when you say it, you like pound your fist. You say it like you're in a courtroom and you're trying to convince somebody else of it. Or you're saying it as I'm giving a drusha and I have to put some added emphasis and some added strength to what I'm saying. So I'm not just saying, I failed, I'm not a failure. I failed, I'm not a failure. It's not going to work, right? I failed, I'm not a failure. And I won't make up a song about it. But you could make, you know, so those types of strategies, again, it's source number two. So Salanter talks about it, and it overlaps with some therapy stuff. Last page. We're almost there, guys. Almost there. Source number 24, skip 23 for a second, two brief strategies. 24, again, taken from Jewish Spiritual Practices by Rabbi Buxbaum, says that you can use social pressure in a positive way. Usually we think peer pressure as bad, but sometimes social pressure is good. And that is that if I can bring a friend on board to help keep us together strong, maybe a therapist, maybe a mentor, but somebody who I'm accountable to, that's very powerful. Because if I'm just doing it on my own, then I can get lost in my own thoughts. I can get lost in my own self. I want to externalize it, put some social pressure into it. I have to report to somebody. I have to get back to somebody about how I did this week. That's a good strategy that we use in therapy, and it's a good strategy for Musser, as he puts here. And then finally, source number 23, mental preparation. So we'll read this one inside. So Rabbi Buxbaum writes as follows, quoting the Sefer Erech HaPayim, make it a practice many times a day, for example, as soon as you wake up in the morning and every time you leave your house to go to the synagogue or the Beit Medrash, whenever you leave there to go home, especially when you leave your house to go to work or to be in the company of other people for any reason, that you go over verbally, speaking out loud, the difficulties that might arise and the bad things that you could become involved in regarding your own behavior in the situation you are entering. It's very powerful. I recommend this all the time. We get like sidelined, or like we think that like things that happened to us over the course of our day came out of nowhere. And if you just took a step back and predicted what was going to happen during your day, how that coworker was going to behave, or how your spouse was going to behave, how your kids, etc., blah, etc., etc., you know exactly what's going to happen. Right? So if before that happens, before you start your day, you sit and you predict it, that's a very powerful strategy to prevent. And then put the coping sentence in. When that happens, I will do this. Now you're prepared for it. And it's not hitting you by surprise. Okay, so now, putting this all together. I know there's a ton of stuff here. But putting this all together, part eight, let's put it into a case study. So one example, the example we're going to use is eating. Why the example we're using is eating? Because we all presumably have some level of struggle with this at some points in our lives. Eating healthy, it's, according to the Rambam, a spiritual thing that we should be working on. There's a tshuva element to this as well. And there's a tremendous amount of help in the therapeutic literature about how to diet healthily, although not everybody's in favor of the term diet, but how to approach food in a healthy manner. So eating, it's also a neutral sort of topic. It's not too controversial. It's not too, you know, it's eating. So let's go through briefly some of the things as a recap in terms of eating, how we can put this all into motion. So number one is set realistic goals. Your goal is not to eat 1,000 calories every day. It's not going to work. Right? So set realistic goals as to how you're going to interact. If you're going to say, I'm going to eat 1,500 calories or 2,000 calories a day, however you want, again, go to the nutritionist, et cetera, to figure all this out. But if you say that, but then you also happen to go to various programs and shirim and kiddushes where there's lots of food, be realistic about incorporating that into your diet. So set realistic goals as to what you're doing. Number two, build motivation, self-efficacy, your ability that you think you can do it, responsibility, mindfulness, meaning use the strategies of Ein Adavar Tolui Ela Bi, this is all based on me, this is all related to me, as well as the pros and cons that we saw, the coping statements, I can do this, I can tolerate this, this isn't too much for me, I can go on this diet, it's one day at a time, I can do it today, I can do it tomorrow, I can keep up with it. So I'm going to keep building those statements, as well as, we didn't allude to this explicitly, but 2C is bibliotherapy, which is basically just read about it, keep it on your mind. Read books about the topic you're trying to work on, whether it's food, anxiety, etc. Read about it. So that's two. Three, self-monitoring. You have to know what you're eating. You have to know what's going in your mouth, not just about what you're eating, when you're eating, where you're eating, what are you thinking when you're eating, what are you feeling when you're eating. You can create, there are apps for this that help you do this, but you can create a whole intense self-monitoring process to keep track of both in terms of what I'm eating as well as my emotions and thinking and behaviors surrounding eating. Number four, stimulus control. Don't bring the food into your house. Right? Remember, stimulus control is setting up the environment for success. If you keep bringing the food that you end up, I'm good for 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, I'm good. I get home from work, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, okay, I'm good, I got this, 10 o'clock, boom, it's over. I lost my willpower, I have no strength. Okay, at that moment, if you have the food in the house, you have a decent chance of failing. We can try to build up your self-control, but you have a decent chance of failing. So don't keep it in the house. Don't keep the alcohol in the house. Keep it away from you. That's stimulus control. Number five, create a system of rewards and punishments. If I eat healthy this week, I will take myself out to get a manicure. I don't know, whatever men or women like to do. Or I'll buy a safer. Whatever it is, I'll reward myself, and I'll have some level of healthy punishment if I don't follow through. I'll give money to tzedakah, etc., etc. Number six, predict the future. This was what we just did with the source 23. Predict the future. It's called implementation intentions. I'm going to predict that when I get to that kiddush, there will be cake. I'm not going to be surprised. Oh my gosh, I can't believe there's cake at this kiddush again. What am I going to do? When I get to the kiddush, there will be cake. And I have a mental statement in my head. If I see cake, I will turn around. Right? And that's when I see it, now I'm prepped. When I see it, I turn around. If I see cake, I will go to talk to somebody. So I have a strategy, a prediction, and a strategy. Number seven, positive social pressure. Bring your friends in on this, only if they're good friends. Right? Sometimes you could ruin relationships with this. If you ask somebody to monitor you and it can get tense, I actually don't recommend asking a spouse to monitor you. That can get, it's not their job, and it can create a lot of tension. But if you have a close friend who's supportive and empathetic and not having to deal with all of the daily sort of, you know, things that you're struggling with, but you can go to, or a therapist, etc., create some level of social commitment and incentivizing to use that, to use the weight. And they do that in stick.com also, I referred to this before, is that you can create social groups of, like, you know, games or tasks, or like who can do this better for the week, and you create some level of social, positive social pressure.
Competition
to be able to do it well. Number eight, fight cognitive distortions and irrational beliefs. So there's a famous cognitive distortion when it comes to eating. It's called the what the heck effect. Meaning, if this is black and white thinking. I ate one potato chip, I might as well just eat the whole bag, right? I messed up my diet for this morning, the whole day is just over, the whole week, the whole month, it's just done. So that's illogical, that's a false belief, it's not true. You messed up, okay, but now do better going forward. There's no, once I did it, now I'm done for the day. So that's fixing the cognitive distortion, catching that thinking, fighting it, telling yourself it's just false. It's not true. Sheker. Number nine, as you're going through maybe a taiva, if you will, you feel, you see that cake, you feel, you can taste it in your mouth. So now you're already too, you're like, you're it almost like, I have to eat it. So number one, do you have to eat it? No, because you don't have to do anything. No needs, no demands. Number two, the stop skills. Stop. Take a step back. Do your cost-benefit analysis. Think about what you're doing. Is this really what I want to do? Insert a pause in between your urge and the behavior. And then the tip strategy. Pour cold water on your face. Go ahead. Go out of the room. Leave the cake. Throw it in the garbage. Put your face in cold water and go do some exercise. Okay? Fight the urge. And then we'll finish off with this, work through unhealthy emotions. This is where it gets complicated, and this is where the therapy versus the just self-help comes into play more, is that if I have an unhealthy emotion about my eating or about whatever I'm talking about, it just throws a monkey wrench. It gets a lot more complicated. Because if when I tell myself, I messed up my diet today, therefore I am a failure, therefore I am worthless, therefore, I get my thinking leads to me being depressed. Now, when I'm depressed, I'm going to have a much harder time following through on my goals moving forward. That's already a complicated, it's workable, that's fixable. But keep in mind, you have to be aware of that, because when you're depressed, it's going to be very hard to just shake yourself and snap yourself out of it. But we're going to want to work on, just because I failed doesn't make me a failure. It doesn't make me worthless. And just because I ate, when I tell myself I ate, and I tell myself I shouldn't have ate, and I shouldn't have eaten that, and I place that demand on what I did in the past, we create this struggle in our head. I shouldn't have, absolutely no choice about it, shouldn't have eaten that, but I did, right? Those two thoughts go like this in our brain and create either anger at ourselves or depression. So we need to change the way we're thinking.
I preferred to not eat that. I really didn't want to eat that. It was against my goal of what I wanted to accomplish today. I didn't follow through on my goal. I feel a healthy remorse, and I'm going to try to fix it moving forward in the future. That's the healthy process. But when it gets into the irrational beliefs and unhealthy emotions, again, things just get, seek some help for that. And then the frustration and tolerance. How can I do this? Diets are hard because it's every day. Every day. So number one, first of all, I think the most nutritionists and psychologists recommend this as well. You could have some cheat days, as it were. Cheat days doesn't mean eat everything that you've never eaten in the past week, but you could have some level of eating some stuff that you weren't eating in the other days. But even besides for that, I can cope with this. I can deal with this. I have the power to control myself. It's not too much for me. If I put my mind to it, I can try even harder. I will mess up. And when I mess up, it's okay. I failed. I'm not a failure. And I'll keep trying, tie my shoes and keep going for the next day. So hopefully this was helpful. We can generalize from this specific behavior to other behaviors, to other emotions, to everything else that's going on in your life. And if you want some help, if you're part of the shul, I cannot be your therapist, but I'm more than happy to sit down as a non-therapist, but just work through general strategies. If it's something you're interested in working on now for a tshuva process, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do it this second, but we can set some time to work through some stuff. But appreciate everybody's attention. I will take questions, but before we take... I feel like we should bench. No questions or benching?
How much do we owe you?
Bench.